This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and in these hectic times, it is nice to pause and take a look back, fondly, we hope, at the year we leave behind. We continue our series now with another behind-the-scenes look at some of our favorite segments from 2017, this time with producer Jennifer Brooklyn. Jen, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Frank.
You ever been in here before?
I've been in here a few times, usually impersonating you.
Escorting guests in, getting them comfortable. Now, this is your first year producing the State of Things. What'd you think?
It was fun, but I remember the first time I came in here and talked to you, I said, what do I need, Frank, to be really great at this job? And you said I needed a capacious intellect.
Ooh.
And I was probably more than 50% sure that I knew what that meant, but probably not 60.
I wonder where I got that word. But you have one, and that means you fit in just great with the rest of the staff. It has been a pure joy working with you this past year. And the things that you've turned out, I think some of the segments have been absolutely wonderful. And the first one is a good example of that, your first pick.
Yeah, so I picked a segment of a meet that we have. We spend meaningful time speaking with a single guest on Mondays. It's our Monday meet series, and I picked a teacher who's in the Charlotte system. His name's Justin Ashley, and he was just this absolute superstar teacher who was hiding some major personal demons that he was fighting at the same time. So I loved his honesty, and I loved his story and thought it was really worth sharing.
Let's hear this segment.
At school, I hid it pretty well. I put on that mask, right? We do this for the kids. That's what we tell ourselves, you know, whatever it takes for our children. But at home, you know, my wife and I, we did have several conversations, family, you know, talked to me, but you know, people that are listening right now that have maybe struggled with addiction or depression, we get very defensive about it initially, right? We want to, you know, no one has the audacity to tell us how we're feeling and how we're living. How dare that person do that? But there's some truth to it. If you're hearing it from different people in different places, you're seeing that pattern, getting that feedback, there's a reason for it.
Add to that denial, which is sort of built in, and we'll talk about the addiction here in just a minute, the fact that you're not just out drinking and gambling, right, away the family fortune. You're doing the Lord's work in
sure.
the classroom. So
sure.
you can turn around and say, hey, wait, look at the good I'm doing, right? And that makes it even easier for you to defend what you're doing. Of course, what you're doing is good. A lot of kids are being affected by it. But you did end up abusing several prescription pain medications. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that and how that happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I think teachers, I think we often do that a lot, is we justify harming ourselves for the sake of our students. And that's actually something that's glorified in education culture. You know, we parade that around. But that's ultimately what I was doing. I was taking, we talked about the ADHD medication, you know, and almost fell out of college. So still taking that, but going back to the doctor and needing more of it. To stay up later and work on these lesson plans, to grade these papers, to plan these trainings for teachers. And then the anxiety increased while I was doing that. So going back to the doctor and asking for Xanax, right, to deal with some of those anxiety issues. And then the sleep really started to disappear, not being able to sleep at night. So going to the doctor and getting Ambien. So you have this, you know, trifecta of medications that is just crushing my soul, right, and taking my energy and really my zest for life away. It's a downward spiral.
Well, tell us where that downward spiral took you. What was happening then?
So the summer of the 2014-2015 year, to begin the summer, school had just ended. I had just, you know, been on that high of being the North Carolina Teacher of the Year. And I thought that at that moment, I should be happy, right? I have my summer ahead of me. I'm off, not teaching. I have a few months off. I've reached where I want to be in my career, and I should be a very happy person. And I was the antithesis of happy. I was very depressed, anxious, addicted to prescription pills, had $100 in my bank account. My wife was considering leaving me, wasn't connected with my son, and my whole world was unraveling right there at the beginning of the summer and the end of the school year.
And you, at that point, you recognized it. I mean, you're not looking back and telling me that. That's what you understood in that moment.
Yeah, I could just struggle. It was a struggle to breathe. It was a struggle to continue on. And I was not suicidal. I didn't want to kill myself. I didn't want to take my life. But I did not want to continuing to live in that constant pain.
What'd you do?
I went to rehab. I voluntarily committed myself to rehab. What else does a, you know, dead broke teacher of the year do than that?
I'm telling you, there are other options, and it doesn't turn out well. So,
right.
Yeah.
So in that moment, coming to face to face with my demons and saying, I'm going to do this not just for my wife and not just for my son and not just for my students, but I'm going to do this for myself. And this is going to be the change of my life that I need. This is going to be the moment where I step up and admit that I am hurting myself and hurting others, and I will no longer do this. Taking the courage to do that, it was the scariest, one of the scariest things I think I've ever done in my life is to commit to rehab, because that's a low point. You don't go into teaching saying, you know, in 7 or 8 years, you know, I'm going to, you know, win this award and then I'm going to go check into rehab. You know, you know, you don't plan for that. But that's where I was at, and that was, for me, the turnaround.
There's a clip from my conversation with Justin Ashley, a conversation we had earlier this year on the state of things. I'm talking to Jen Brookland and asking you why that's your favorite. What was it about that interview?
I find it a privilege to ask people for their stories and have them give it to me, and especially coming from a young person who really struggled, for him to come in and be so honest with the path that he had been on. And we found him because he wrote a book about how to help other teachers overcome difficulties and not give so much of themselves in the classroom that they lose what they need to be a human being in the world. So just to hear that raw, personal, honest struggle from him and have him share it with me and with the audience was, I thought, really meaningful.
Yeah, you know, we often hear stories about people who struggle to get where they are, but it tends to be a kind of a one-way street, right? You start at the bottom and you work through difficulties and obstacles and overcome them and then get wherever it was. But here's a guy who basically started at the top and then didn't know what to do with it. It was too much and he was burning himself out. So to hear somebody in that early in life, you know, essentially mess up, stumble and fall, and then pull it together, it's a unique story.
Yeah, he'd been teaching for 7 or 8 years at this point and had won Teacher of the Year in, I think, history and social studies, was just really on top of his game and was hiding these troubles that I'm sure a lot of people are dealing with.
Very cool story. And again, as you say, a privilege to be able to share that on the air. You picked another meet as your favorite, this one with Becky Holmes. Tell us more.
Yeah, Becky, she grew up really poor in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, you know, eating from food pantries and adding water to everything to make it last longer. So when she got to Duke on a full scholarship, she ended up in this entrepreneurship program where she was going to get the support that she needed to start her own business. And she wanted to focus on healthy food that she could kind of take back to the community that she came from. And so she tried a few ideas, and Becky told me that her brother-in-law, who's like this cheeseburger loving, soda drinking, you know, red meat kind of guy, tried these vegan donut holes. And I was like, Becky, this is what you should make.
We are going to play a clip now from that conversation with food entrepreneur Becky Holmes.
I think one thing that set me apart was that I was never afraid to be wrong, never afraid to fail. And that's something, you know, the earlier you learn that, the better off you are. So I knew that how I was going to learn was not to sit and think about how it might work, but to go up and just learn on the spot. So I remember the first call I had with a wholesale, you know, store. I got on the phone. They start asking me some questions. They asked me the case size. I had no idea what that meant. And so I just said, 10 bags, just made up and wrote it down. Okay, 10 bags. So I would remember later. And so I think a lot of it was just throwing myself in it and learning as I go, because that's the only way you're really going to understand it. You can't learn it from books. You have to throw yourself into it. And I think the mentors along the way who could give me those extra pointers that, you know, scaffolded my learning was also very helpful.
This is not a rags to riches story yet. You're still in progress. And in fact, even along the way, I mean, you found yourself kind of living hand to mouth, right?
For sure, for sure. I would say the last year, probably starting last summer, I didn't have enough money to support myself and the company. And so I was at this crossroads of, do I give up? Do I try to get a corporate job or do I keep going? And at that point, I realized I have the energy and the passion to continue doing this. All it means is that my life is going to look a little bit different than my peers. And so at that point, it meant living out of my car. And that was a sacrifice that I said, it's worth it to me to put that money into the business and to run with this. Because I think I always know that even if I'm going through trials and struggles, it's not it's temporary. It's not forever. And so I see that vision of me getting out of it. And so I'm willing to sacrifice now to be able to reap those rewards later.
Let's talk about this other mission, which is to get wholesome food to people who need it. Okay, your brother-in-law eats the donut hole at the vegan place, although he was dragged there over his miraculously over his dead body. He ate it and he liked it. He's not going to go to Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And part of the reason is, and again, if you talk about your family who, as you say, every once in a while would go to food pantries to feed themselves, there's a price point here that's an issue. How did you address that?
Yeah, that was a big, I think, moral or dilemma, and I had to really think about is how do I make a product that my own family can't afford, but this is the business I want to be doing. And so I really had to think, do I subsidize the product? Do I create a less quality product, not focus on raw and organic, create something that's, you know, cheap, or do I focus on something that's profitable? And so I think I kind of had to turn off my conditioning of what I came from about, you know, giving and like the handouts or just low cost, and had to say, let me create a profitable business that I know once it's growing can give back. And so I really had to say, this is the margin. I know right now the market that's purchasing it is not going to be, you know, where I came from, but I know eventually we'll be able to give back and to also help shape this landscape of organic foods and the availability, and that will drive down costs.
That's a clip from our conversation in June with food entrepreneur Becky Holmes. She started the company LO Raw, and she sells raw vegan dessert bites, and it's one of the favorite conversations of producer Jen Brooklyn, who's with me now. What else do you like about that?
I mean, Becky was just so fun to talk to, and we don't often have a meet with someone who's really young. We often meet someone who's older, who's very accomplished. You know, we get to hear all the ups and downs of their lives and all the success they've had in their career. I mean, Becky's really still in the thick of it. She's struggling. She's hustling. She says we, and she does have staff now, but when I first spoke with her, she would say we, and I'd say, Becky, who are you actually talking about? And she's, oh, well, it's just me right now. But she was so aspirational, even in the way she talked about herself and her business. So, you know, she's still kind of trying to think about how to give back and how to make her own company a success, but her energy just came across so palpably, I thought.
By the way, you also shined a light on the genius of the producer. You hear a little twist, we, and the producer in you says, all right, what else do I need to know? So that's what makes a great producer. And all of the, you among all the rest, are great, and I appreciate that kind of attention to detail. Jen Brooklyn is with us. She will tell us more of her favorites when The State of Things continues from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, continuing our conversation with our staff's favorite segments from this past year. My guest today is producer Jennifer Brooklyn. She is on this side of the glass to talk about her picks. What's next?
Well, I want to talk about some mysteries, Frank. The scientists who've come in trying to solve problems and sleuth around that I think were so cool to talk to. And we had several of them. I heard this great podcast about this weird meat allergy that was turning up. People were coming in and saying, I'm allergic to meat. And, you know, doctors didn't even believe them. Right. Our news intern, Jernai Aniwar, found out that one of the doctors researching this weird allergy is actually at UNC. So we got in touch with him. His name's Scott Commons. And he came in to tell us about this sort of medical investigation that they're doing at UNC into this allergy to a sugar called alpha-gal.
Let's listen to this clip with my conversation with University of North Carolina allergist Scott Commons.
It took us a few years to figure this, to piece it together. And we started mainly by beginning to talk to other allergists throughout the South and asking, were they too seeing these patients with reported reactions, delayed reactions to beef and pork and lamb? And by doing that, we began to build, in many ways, a map of places throughout the Southeast in particular where our fellow allergists were also seeing this. And it was slow going at first. We initially published only 24 cases in 2009, and now we know of several thousand. So at the time, we thought this was a fairly isolated thing, but as we talked to more and more folks, they were beginning to see similar patients show up in their clinics.
All right, so now you've got a map of a couple of things now. Who's reporting the allergic response? And you start laying over other maps of things that might be, I don't know if you call them comorbidities, but things that might be the other part, the missing piece of the puzzle, right?
That's right. And we tried thinking about, could it have been a squirrel parasite or other goofy exposures that you might think about in the South? And one of the things that we came up with from just looking at maps was that the distribution of Rocky Mountain spotted fever looked incredibly similar to, number one, the patients who actually were reported to have reactions in the cancer literature from the cetuximab story, but then secondly, to the map that we were beginning to put together of patients showing up in allergists' office throughout the Southeast.
So now what you do is ask them if they've ever been bitten by a tick, eh?
That's right. So I spent a large part of my fellowship calling back patients, Because when we first were enrolling patients in our quote-unquote meat allergy study, we had no idea about tick bites. So absolutely, getting on the horn and calling folks back and asking, this seems like a weird question, but were you by chance bitten by ticks or seed ticks or chiggers? Sort of casting a broad net, and it was striking. Over 95% of them, and at that point we had a few hundred patients that I was calling, were willing to go on record as saying, yes, absolutely, I've had tick bites. And in fact, I often get a monster of a response at the sight of the bite.
And so now we've got a culprit, right? And is it a particular kind of tick?
Well, in the Southeast, we are fairly confident that it's this Lone Star tick, which goes by the scientific name Amblyomma americanum.
Lone Star, owing to the marking on its back, not the fact that it may come from Texas.
Correct.
It may not.
Only the female Lone Star, in fact, has the white mark on its back.
Right.
I have difficulty telling the male Lone Star ticks from other dog ticks.
Oh, I'll show you how to do that. That's a clip of my July conversation with UNC allergist Scott Cummins on the growing allergy to alpha-gal, which is found in mammal meat. I absolutely love this because, again, it was science, but so much a mystery story and sort of how you – and kind of how science works, the kind of sharp questioning that you have to make in order to come to a sensible conclusion.
Well, sharp questioning, but actually his mentor on this project ended up – mysteriously being infected himself with a bunch of tick bites. He then developed this meat allergy, the rumor, of course, being mm-hmm. that he experimented a little bit on himself. But yeah, sharp questioning, I'm sure, played a role as well.
All right, what do you have next for us?
So another science guest that we had that really impressed me was Rachel Lance. She came in to talk about her investigation into what sank the Hunley. That was part of her PhD research. And the Hunley was the first combat submarine to successfully sink a warship. It was in 1864. So the Hunley sank in the process of successfully taking down the submarine, and no one really knew why. I am not a Civil War history buff, but Rachel was just, well, basically she was obsessed. but that comes across as passion on the radio. And I mean, even in the pre-interview that I did with her, I just wanted to learn more and more.
Before we get to the clip, I want to talk just a little bit more about this as a producer, because often you're assigned stories that, you know, you may or may not have a deep interest in. And then there's that other secret ingredient, which is the passion or lack of it on the part of a guest, potentially, which is something that you're listening for. And that's the value added that could push a piece over the top or sink it in your mind. How do you make those judgments?
I like the sink reference when we're talking about the Hunley.
That's a good one.
yeah, I mean, you know, as a producer, you can ask, you know, what is the most interesting or what was the most surprising or the most shocking thing to you when you were looking into this? And sometimes that will suddenly get them to light up about the thing that they really want to talk about. That wasn't really in their talking points.
And that is the trick to making this show great. But let's listen now to this clip of a conversation about what sank the Hunley with biomedical engineer Rachel Lance.
So where it was found was really interesting, and it was a big factor of why it was not found for such a long period of time. People had looked for it after it sank the Housatonic in the 1800s, but they had all looked between the Housatonic's wreck site and shore. So people knew where the Housatonic had sank. Its rigging had still been sticking up out of the water. It was only in 30 feet of water. So the Hunley itself actually ended up being found seaward, and that's why it took so long to discover it. It was found about 310 meters away, and because it was found so far away, and based on the general shape of the boat, we can conclude that it needed to have drifted for quite a while after it sank. So that in itself is pretty interesting and eliminates some of the theories, because if it had started sinking right away, it would have been found much closer to the Housatonic.
Right. And if they were alive in the immediate aftermath, they probably would have been peddled into shore.
Exactly.
But they were in the opposite direction. And you can take a look at the sea currents and the currents and things at the time, and that would at least give a plausible explanation for why they were in the other direction.
Exactly.
Not under power.
Yep.
All right, well, let's talk about the theories then. What were people saying about how... about why it went down.
So one theory was called the lucky shot theory. As the Hunley approached the Housatonic, the crew on deck of that ship knew it was coming. They spotted it. It was too close to train their cannons on it, but they had personal firearms, and so they were firing at the submarine as it approached. The lucky shot theory stated that one of them managed to hit the hull in such a way that it sank the submarine, or that it managed to shoot through one of the little deadlight windows and kill the lieutenant who was piloting it. If it had sank the submarine directly, by definition, that submarine would have been found right next to the wreck site of the Housatonic. And there were no remnants of a bullet casing found inside the submarine or any indications that that crewman had in any way been shot. So I did some ballistic testing with other researchers as part of my PhD, and we also showed that any of the damage to the conning tower didn't really match the ballistics that would have occurred. The other more plausible theory was that they suffocated inside the closed hull. So they got oxygen by opening the hatches of their two conning towers and just basically letting the boat refresh from the atmosphere outside. When the boat was found, the rear conning tower was still locked. So they had not only made no effort to move from their seats, they didn't make any effort to even open the hatch.
And forgive me, it's not in very deep water. So the idea of being able to get up to the surface to open those hatches wasn't far-fetched. They were only in 30, 40 feet
correct.
Of water, right?
Yeah, they were only in about 35 feet of water where the boat was finally found. And they also had the ability to release all of their weights from inside the vessel. And they didn't make any effort to do that either. So I did some math and looked at the volume of gas inside of the submarine and combined that with things that we know from just general respiratory physiology, which obviously has many decades of research, and concluded that they would have had at least 10 minutes of warning before they ran out of air. What would have given them the warning was the buildup of carbon dioxide inside that closed hull. Carbon dioxide has some very uncomfortable and noticeable symptoms. I've experienced it. It is not pleasant. And you definitely have this sensation that you're continuously gasping for breath. And it also has some physical discomfort, too. So the fact that they would have experienced that and then had at least 10 minutes to take corrective action and they didn't really indicates that that theory isn't plausible either and that their demise was a lot more sudden.
So what do you think happened?
Well, what I think happened, and I am biased,
it's not like you came to it with a prejudice. You actually tested this theory. Go ahead.
So this was the subject of part of my PhD dissertation. Along with other researchers, of course, nobody stands alone in science. But we built a scale model of the Hunley, and it was a 1/6 scale model, so it's about 6.5 feet long, and we exposed it to scaled black powder charges. What we showed was that the pressure from those charges propagated inside the hull of the boat at a level that was sufficient that the crew inside would have experienced fatal injuries from blast trauma. So what that would have appeared like to them is they would have had immediate pulmonary and brain trauma resulting from those high pressures.
I mean, does that mean that the shock waves actually sort of went from the hull of the Housatonic, right? That's where the charge led off. Now you got shock waves, I assume, going in all directions.
It's pretty omnidirectional. It would have actually been stronger in the direction of the Hunley because it would have had a reflection off of the Housatonic. So they kind of, there's no way they would have had the blast knowledge to really understand that phenomenon at the time, but they inadvertently set themselves up for sort of a perfect storm of blast exposure.
There is a clip of my conversation about what sank the Hunley with biomedical engineer Rachel Lance, one of Jen Brooklyn's favorites from 2017. What'd you like about that interview?
I mean, besides Rachel's obvious passion for the topic, she's a true expert. I mean, she has spent so much time investigating every little detail. Sometimes when you're talking to someone who knows a lot about something, but you're not sure if they really know every detail. It's like watching figure skating, right? Where you're kind of cringing and holding your breath a little bit just in case they fall and you're so nervous about it. But Rachel, it was just obvious she was going to do a triple sow cow and land it.
On a submarine, which is really hard to do. Also, we didn't hear that in that clip, but she talked about the pushback she got and how she handled some of the criticism from the so-called experts who didn't want to hear that somebody had come up with a new and, frankly, better grounded theory.
Oh, she was so funny about it. She just said, I've done the science. I've done all these, I've crunched all these numbers, and you are welcome to try to disprove them. please do publish a paper. I will gladly read it. I think she actually said, I'm not sure any of them actually read my paper.
That's right.
But no, she's a scientist.
What's next on your list?
Next is a conversation we had with Alex Dornberg. He's the curator of fishes at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. He is studying the evolution of fish to find real-world applications in conservation and public health.
Well, why don't we listen to this clip of my conversation with ichthyologist Alex Dornberg.
Evolution is sort of this trigger word, if you think about it. Like, as soon as I say it, people are probably reaching for the dial or please don't, right? But it's something that when we think about evolution as evolutionary biologists, we're thinking about change through time, right? So anybody who's been on Ancestry.com, right, is asking about, you know, your own genealogy, right? And evolutionary biologists, we're just looking back further sometimes. Sometimes we are actually at the same, about the same level as genealogy. So, you know, where's this virus coming from in the last 30 years? And other times we're going back millions of years. So that type of thinking, by having a genealogy of where life has been and where it's going, is actually incredibly powerful for disease research. Just imagine for a second that you're looking down at your arm and you're thinking about a cancer cell, and it's metastasizing and spreading and spawning all of these new cells that are traveling. That is a genealogy. If you know what that genealogy is, you know what genes are activating in what sequence. If you have enough of those, you can develop new targets because you have a roadmap. Without that roadmap, things look really crazy. But what we're seeing is this push towards integrating this type of thinking into cancer research, and some of the discoveries have been truly amazing.
Like what?
So this one of the coolest, I think, is people have applied this concept of molecular clocks, so using DNA to figure out how long ago these cells shared a common cell, basically, or diverged. So in doing this, what they're finding is fuse times of certain types of cancers that, you know, usually when you detect the primary, the life expectancy is on the order of months, so they're incredibly aggressive cancers. But for some autopsies that people have done, they have found fuse times, so that those lineages were already present in the body for decades, 40 years. So that really pushes back, you know, early detection, right? You can, right. You know, if you have decades worth of, you know, areas we can focus to develop new detection technologies, right?
That before it manifests.
Yeah, before it manifests. That's incredible insight from, right, you know, being able to use these genealogies. I recently got involved in a totally crazy that departure from fishes. I started working with a collaborator of mine who's at the Yale School of Public Health, who's also worked with me on fish-related projects, kind of odd that way too. And what he's been interested in is studying how to basically figure out missing case numbers in disease outbreaks like Ebola. So he figured out that by applying genealogies of Ebola virus to people who have sequenced, you can know how many mutations there are between the patients. So if you know how many mutations there are and you know what the background rate of mutation is, if you imagine a bunch of people all have very similar strains, and then suddenly you go to another village and you're seeing that you've sequenced a few people and their strains have lots and lots of mutations between them. You know there's a lot. You know that there will be a lot more cases around there, and he was actually able to figure out like how many, right? So
can you find pockets where there is none, and sort of again on the same theory, say, wait a minute, if I put this on a map.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, you know, X here and X plus 10 there. If I go halfway between, there's X plus 5, and I bet I'll see an outbreak in that middle ground.
Yeah, so what you can do is you can then combine that type of information with the models of where people go and the regular disease models, right? So you can basically refine your estimates. And during the outbreak, if you guys remember the news, the estimates were between 10,000 and like 1.4 million. So imagine being a health worker who's trying to figure out where to deploy your resources most efficiently and what you even need. Having that sort of information up front is absolutely incredible. And being able to now use all these advances in sequencing technology to get these estimates quicker could be incredibly powerful for, you know, any type of outbreak, because you now can basically say, oh.
You can get there before you see it,
exactly.
Before it manifests.
Yeah,
right? It's bound
and
to be there when
check.
You show up and know what to bring.
Yeah, exactly.
That was part of our conversation with Alex Dornberg in August, a research curator at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. And the reason I will confess to you, the reason I love this, apart from the fact that it's very interesting, got a lot of good feedback, I get to say ichthyologist.
I know, Frank. That is one of the reasons that we booked this guest.
Because, you know, I just jumped out of my skin. I said, an ichthyologist? This is great.
I think you said it a few times during the interview just to get it out there.
And I've said it several times here. We used to, when I had a burn, you know, we had something my mom would put on called ichthyol ointment. Some of our listeners will remember that. It was a dark, pasty, tarry stuff made from fish oil that was good for burns. But we did get a lot of feedback on this. It's amazing. And again, it's one of those things that you think, some guy's going to talk about fish. What do you mean? And then our listeners write in and say, wow, that guy was amazing.
Well, I mean, his enthusiasm, again, if you had been in the studio, well, which you were, but for other people who are not, I mean, he was waving his arms around. He was, you know, our sound engineer lovingly mic checks everyone who comes in here, and then he would just lean in and give this booming laugh, messing everything up. But he was just so excited about the topic that you couldn't help but be as well.
What's it like for you as somebody who has talked to this person longer than I do to hear it go out? Because I know there's got to be some, I'll call it frustration with not hearing everything that you heard on the pre-interview. And I just want to get your feelings for sort of the difference between what you heard in the pre-interview and then what we end up with on the air.
Yeah, there's so much that we often hear from guests that don't make it to the air. And we try to capture some of it, perhaps, in the web posts that we put up and some of the social media. But, you know, I've learned now in this job that I write guideposts for you and then you bushwhack your own trail. So whatever path through the woods you two find together in the studio, usually when I listen back after a little bit of time, I don't remember all the things that I heard at one point. It just sounds like a fun conversation.
Jennifer Brooklyn, one of the producers on The State of Things, will be back with us to talk about her favorites from 2017. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and the year is coming to a close. We thought we would take a look back not only at your life and how the year has been for you, but how the year has been for us. Here on The State of Things, some of our favorite programs from the year 2017, and here to help us today is producer Jennifer Brooklyn to talk about some of her favorites from the year gone by. What's next on your list?
Well, we just talked about some rogue scientists, and I want to talk about a sort of rogue educator that came on our program. We spoke with Kathy Davidson, author of The New Education, How to Revolutionize the University to Prepare Students for a World in Flux. She's such a distinguished educator. She was the country's first vice provost of interdisciplinary studies. But I just knew Kathy was going to be a really fun guest because the email that she sent me to coordinate to come on our show talked about how she is Frank Stacio's biggest fangirl. And there were like eight R's in fangirl. Right. I just thought it was so funny.
Used to teach at Duke.
Yes.
Has been on the show before. Right?
Yes. Yeah. So I knew that she was obviously young at heart and had a lot of spirit to share.
Well, let's talk about that and hear the conversation, or at least part of it, with higher education expert and author Kathy Davidson.
The problem is that the structure we've inherited was invented for the industrial age, for the age of the Model T and the assembly line. And even our hierarchies and our ranking system, our accreditation system, still supports that system. So it's hard to change when you're being judged against a system that was invented over 100 years ago.
Well, what is it about that system? I mean, look, we have these departments, we have specialties. That's good. It allows us to focus on particular areas, chemistry, physics, the humanities. But you're saying that those silos now are just no longer helpful for what we're trying to do.
They don't match very well with the world we're living in. They were invented as professions were being designed and developed. People often say the higher education hasn't changed since Socrates walked across the floor of the academy. That's so not true. Between about 1860 and 1925 in America, people really set about saying, how does this new world of industrialization, how do people get educated for this world? And they invented law school. professional schools, nursing schools, business schools, medical, graduate school. Most people don't realize those are new. Credit hours, grades. These are things that we think of were always there. No, they were invented for a very specific time. Our times have changed. So I heard yesterday from a counselor that about 10% of students actually go into a profession that maps on to what they majored in college. So that leaves out 90% of students. And many of the most interesting programs, in fact, span disciplines, span professional schools and arts and letters, span sciences and social sciences, divisions which were made for the last big reform movement in higher education, again, at the turn into the 20th century.
So does this really require a revolution, or can schools just be a little bit more mindful and intentional about interdisciplinary programs?
If they're willing to take the periphery and actually do an involution where what's at the outside becomes the center, and they don't think that's revolutionary, then that's fine. I don't care. I'm not concerned about the word we use. For most universities, that would be pretty revolutionary. Because one of the things is it means going against accreditation systems. Hampshire College, a progressive college in, founded in the 1970s in Massachusetts, did something about 5 years ago. It said to realign its mission. They abolished the keeping of any records about SAT or ACT scores. Now, they said they had been discounting those scores for a long time, but now they don't even keep the data. What that means is they could no longer be in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. That means they took a huge risk of no longer being visible in ranking systems. They even had to work with local Northeastern accreditation systems about could they be accredited because they don't use SAT scores. Most people have no idea that those things are linked together and how serious it is and how hard it is to make those changes.
Give us a blueprint of what your system would look like and, again, what accountability would look like under that system.
So I think all the things that changed between 1860 and 1965 give us a good blueprint of what has to change. And they have to be changing on that level from the classroom and how we teach our individual students. And that can change tomorrow. Most teachers can change the way they teach tomorrow. All the way up into how we finance higher education, whether it's private education, through corporate funds, through huge endowments, through this kind of escalating competition over who has the most facilities on their campus, to even more seriously, public funding of higher education, which is in dire, dire straits right now.
So, and again, does this mean that we need, I mean, should those buildings still be there? Or are we talking about a kind of interdisciplinary approach that doesn't even require a university and an English class and a physics program and a chemistry program?
I think you can do a lot within those buildings and outside them. Mm-hmm. I taught one great class at Duke one time where my students had to do ethnographies not by departments, not by fields, but by buildings. They had to talk to the housekeepers. They talked to the janitorial staff who was there at night. They talked to everybody who walked in and out the building. They were shocked to find out people in different departments who were in the same building, sometimes in the same hallway, did not even know each other's names. You know, we're so siloed and so divided. Now, that makes no sense to me. The universities I studied that and the people I met who are doing the most interesting things ask big, complicated questions. At Arizona State University, there's a new school in art, design, and engineering, where each year the first-year students, just as they're entering, have to deal with a huge problem. One of my favorites was one year the question they were told to ask was, what will life be like in Phoenix when there's no more water? Now, that's a question that every student entering can feel because there's almost no more water. But to answer the question, the students then had to map their way through the curriculum. So instead of a smorgasbord of general education courses, everything was, how do we answer that question? Who's going to be affected? How does water systems work? Where do we get our water systems from? How much does it cost? Who will be served and who won't be served? What are the ethics of water distribution? What are the ethics of clean water? What if we privatize water? You know, there are many different questions that aren't just about the science of hydrology, but the ethics of hydrology. That's an amazing way to get an education. It's an amazing way to begin college because it told them their first year of college, the importance of college is to learn deeply, to think deeply, but also to think about how what I'm being educated in can help my society, help the world I'm living in. Not just help me, but the world I'm living in, since I don't know too many humans who live outside the world. This is the world we got.
That was a clip of my conversation with Kathy Davidson, who spent a career in higher education, used to teach at Duke. She is now the author of The New Education, How to Revolutionize the University and Prepare Students for a World of Flux, one of the favorites of Jen Brooklyn, who's a producer here on The State of Things. What else did you like about that?
It made me look at the system that I've grown up in, and I'm very accustomed to higher learning, and you know, I've come through various universities, and Kathy's segment just made me look at it in a whole new way, just thinking, yeah, why do we need these siloed classes, and why do we need grades, and why is it, you know, not interdisciplinary, and why doesn't it start earlier in high school or middle school or kindergarten? So just thinking about the system that we've erected for ourselves and how far back it goes. Kathy talked about the history of this going all the way back to 1860s with the president of Harvard setting up the system for an industrializing age. And it made a lot of sense then. But it's the kind of thing that when you're immersed in a system, you don't always think twice about it. And she made me think twice.
You know, it's interesting, too, because we get a lot of pitches about various forms of alternative education, ways to look at it. I mean, they do come in pretty frequently. And for us, the question is how to sort these so that we're really not looking at the one of many alternatives, but someone who can take that one step back and give us a larger picture and a deeper context so that we can understand even the question we're asking and why we would ask such a question. And Kathy Davidson is one of the people who can do that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Kathy had such expansive experience and knowledge about this. She's obviously researched it so deeply. She's traveled the country collecting examples, concrete examples of people that are doing it differently, from professors to students to administrators. But Kathy, I mean, really brings up what it means to learn, not just to learn a subject, but how we learn about learning and how we learn about how we learn.
And that leads to other segments, because we did something later in the year, much more recently, about education and how we learn. That was a whole show that you produced on education. And again, if you think about a show on education, man, that can get tedious pretty darn fast, just because you can get in the weeds quickly. But we had this, in a sense, a foundation, right? We almost had a framework with which to ask ourselves, what's the best show to build it? And we, in many ways, built the show on this particular segment, or what we learned from this segment.
That's right. We decided to do a concept show on education, which is just taking a more holistic look at a topic overall and really grounding it. And yeah, Kathy's conversation, I think, was a springboard for that kind of inquiry. Why is the education system in our country set up the way it is? What does it really look like? Why is it in place? And what can we change about it?
Here's the thing you never do. You never talk about MIME on the radio.
It's very rare and difficult.
We figured out a way. You did. Tell us about this.
Sean Wen did. Sean Wen used to be a producer on The State of Things. She wrote a book of lyrical essays about Marcel Marceau, the world's most famous mime, something I could not have cared less about before her book came in. And then I just got totally hooked. And it was such a weird segment, mostly because you performed the voice of the voiceless mime, Marcel Marceau.
It was right. Why don't we listen to this clip? We can come back and talk some more. This is a former State of Things producer, Sean Wen, talking about her book about Marcel Marceau.
I constructed it very much as a collage. The genre lyric essay means it's a hybrid of poetry and nonfiction writing. And at first, it was just like kind of like a jumbled mess of facts and ideas and little poems that I'd written. And the form began to make sense to me once I started to write sort of these poems that have nothing to do with Marcel Marceau, these poems about the sensory experience of sitting in a theater and watching a man with a body much more articulate than your own moving in front of you. Or what is it to refuse speech? Or what is it to listen? Or what is it to observe? So once those were put together, and those kind of like leak in my point of view more than any other section of the book, the rest of it sort of fell into place.
Well, let's read a section, and I say let's because I'm told I'm taking a part in this. Am I right?
That's right. I always read with someone else doing the voice of Marceau.
Well, I'm doing this mainly because I have the chance to actually give voice to Marcel Marceau on the radio, and this is probably my only chance to do it. So, so I'm happy to play the part. So I will be speaking the parts of Marcel Marceau.
That's right. So I'll begin. Marceau on speech.
I don't suffer from silence. I could be 2 days without speaking. I wouldn't suffer at all.
Marcel Marceau's first wife divorced him in 1958. She said he would not speak to her for days on end. She called it mental cruelty. He called it rehearsal. His third wife, Anne Seco, called mime his only way of thinking and expressing himself. But then Studs Terkel said, only one guy out-talked me, Marcel Marceau. I couldn't get a word in. He used his hands as he spoke. There used to be a rumor that he was a deaf mute. He dispelled this rumor by appearing on talk shows. Johnny Carson, Flip Wilson, Merv Griffin.
I'm obliged to talk. I don't like to talk especially.
But Marcel Marceau had a reputation. Those who conversed with him found his conversation as entertaining as his stage performance. His English was nearly flawless.
I think I'm not so different from other people in my private life, except that I don't like very much to socialize. I'm rather a person who is on his own. I like to paint, I like to read, to write, and to travel so much, you know.
There's a joke that Marcel Marceau released an album. The record consists of 20 minutes of silence, followed by applause.
Tell us about his life, because you mentioned his three wives. I mean, the fact is he really abused his family in support of his own career.
Yeah. Famously, even now when you hear interviews with, I mean, there are not very many interviews with his family, but they do mention that he was performing 200 shows a year, 300 shows a year, basically his entire life. I was really interested in that idea that he would have his family decimated in the Holocaust. And then when he created his own families, he essentially abandoned them.
Creating these various persona. Bip the Clown, I suppose, the most iconic figure that he created, right?
Right. And Bip is very much kind of an everyman sort of figure, modeled. He claims it was modeled after Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp. Bip also borrows a lot of tropes from a figure called Pierrot, which is kind of like this classic, sad, moonstruck dreamer sort of a character.
And this is a character, this part of the story of Bip, I think, contains within it the story of, in some ways, Marceau's own destruction. He creates a character that is accessible to every man for all time, and therefore will never change it.
That's right. I think one of the, I'm asked often, do you think that Marcel Marceau was successful or not? Which is kind of an interesting question, right? Because he, on the one hand, is the most famous mime of all time. All of our ideas of what a mime is, all of our cliches, that a mime is French, that a mime has white face paint, that a mime wears a white sailor suit, those are all Marcel Marceau. At the same time, though, he made us hate mime, as it were. I mean, all of my associations with it growing up were of like anvils and hammers and safes falling on them from Warner Brothers cartoons, right? I think that in some ways, you could also argue that he's a very tragic figure, that he failed in his mission because he opened the door, became the mime, and then closed it behind him.
That was part of my conversation with Sean Nguyen, a former producer here on The State of Things and the author of A 20-Minute Silence, followed by Applause, a book of lyrical essays about Marcel Marceau. As you said, you didn't want to, you know, you weren't particularly interested, but after talking to Sean, who really had her own way of coming at everything, so I'm not surprised that she would come up with this fairly unique approach to Marcel Marceau, what'd you think about it?
Oh, it was fascinating. I mean, this man lost his parents in the Holocaust at the age of 16, I believe, joined the French Resistance. And when the war was over, pivoted into this amazing career where he sort of drove himself to the point of probably insanity,
yeah,
trying to
close.
Be a performer. Yeah. And then, as Sean said in the interview, created this stereotype, which then really caged him in, to sort of use a mime pun.
Well, you're leaving us to do this wonderful thing, to have a baby. We will leave a space for you so that you and your children can come back anytime, because we'll deeply miss you while you're gone. But we're going to hold a space open for you.
Thank you. And when I came in today, there was this little mic for a mandolin that I think might work perfectly for a small child.
But now you can really write a book, can't you? Or can you write, just given all the things that you've had to research in the past year?
Well, maybe if I just turned them into lyrical essays and put less pressure on myself to write an entire book. Yeah, I think that might be a great approach.
And then make them pantomime and you won't have to talk about them. Jennifer Brooklander, producer on The State of Things, who joined me on this side of the glass for a conversation about her favorite conversations in 2017. Happy New Year, Jen.
Happy New Year.
You can find out more about our show at the website stateofthings.org. Produced by, in addition to Jen, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, Armin, Laura Pelliser, and of course Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.